he thought, hopping. If only it could be achieved. If only one could experience inspiration. If there could be one unique opportunity. Something flashed below the terrace. The darkness of the night ruptured like a starburst, and a horse emerged from the flare, with a rider on its back. The rider was a girl. "Good evening," she greeted him politely. "I'm sorry if it's a bad time. May one know what place this is, and what time?" Arrhenius Krantz swallowed, opened his mouth, and mumbled. "The police," the girl repeated patiently and clearly.
"The time?"
The horse snorted. The girl sighed. "Well, it must be the wrong place again. The wrong place, the wrong time. But answer me, fellow, with at least one comprehensible word, for I can't be in a world where people have forgotten articulate speech."
One little word?
"Then bugger you stupid old goat," said the girl, and vanished, along with the horse. Arrhenius Krantz closed his mouth. He stood for a while by the balustrade, staring into the night, at the lake and the distant lights of Vichima reflected in it. Then he buttoned up his trousers and returned to his telescope. The comet swiftly flashed across the sky. One ought to observe it, not let the eyepiece and eye lose sight of it. Track it until it disappeared into the chasms of the universe. It was an opportunity, and a scholar cannot waste such an opportunity. "Perhaps I could try from another direction," she thought, staring at the two moons above the moor, now visible as two crescents, one small, the other large and less crescent. "Perhaps not imagine places or faces," she thought, "but strongly wish for something, very strongly, right from my belly. What harm is there in trying?" "Geralt. I want to go to Geralt. I very much want to go to Geralt." "Oh, no," she cried. "What if I bloody ended up now?" Kelpie confirmed that she thought the same by whinnying, belching steam from her nostrils and scraping her snowbound hooves. The blizzard whistled and moaned, blinding them. Sharp snowflakes stung her cheeks and hands. The cold chilled her to the marrow, nipped her joints like a wolf. Ciri trembled, hunching her shoulders and hiding her neck in the meagre, non-existent protection of her turned-up collar. To the left and right rose majestic, menacing peaks, grey, glazed monuments whose summits vanished somewhere high up in the fog and blizzard. A swift, very swollen river, dense with frazil and lumps of ice, sped along the bottom of the valley. It was white all around, and cold.
"So much for my abilities," thought Ciri, feeling the inside of her nose freezing. "So much for my power. A fine master of the worlds. Well, well. I wanted to go to Geralt, and I ended up in the middle of some bloody wilderness, winter and blizzard. Come on, Kelpie, move or you'll go numb."
She grabbed the reins with fingers paralysed by the frost.
Gee up, girl. I know it's not the place it's meant to be. I'll soon get us out of here. We'll soon return to our warm moor. But I have to concentrate, and that may take some time. So move yourself. Come on, right."
Kelpie belched steam from her nostrils. The strong wind blew. Snow stuck to her face, melting on her eyelashes. The freezing snowstorm howled and whistled.
"Look!" called Angoulême, outshouting the blizzard. "Look there! There are tracks! Someone rode that way!"
"What are you saying?"
Geralt unwrapped the shawl he had wrapped around his head to protect his ears from frostbite.
"What are you saying, Angoulême?"
"Tracks! Hoofprints!"
"A horse! Here!"
Kair also had to shout. The blizzard intensified, and the river sans retour, it seemed, whooshed and roared even louder.
"How could a horse get here?"
Look for yourselves.
Indeed, commented the vampire, the only member of the company who wasn't displaying symptoms of being utterly frozen, since he was, for obvious reasons, just as insensitive to low as to high temperatures. Hoof prints. But are they a horse's?
It's impossible for it to be a horse.
Kair massaged his cheeks and nose hard.
Not in the middle of nowhere. The tracks must have been left by some wild animal. Most probably a mouflon.
Mouflon yourself? Yelled Angoulême. When I say a horse, I mean a horse.
Milva, as usual, preferred practice to theory. She dismounted and bent over, pushing her fox fur kalpak back on her head.
The pup's right, she decided after a moment. It's a horse. I think it's even shod, but it's hard to say. The blizzard has covered the tracks. It rode over there into that ravine.
Ha!
Angoulême banged her arms together briskly.
I knew it. Somebody lives here, in the vicinity. Let's follow the trail. Perhaps we'll find some warm cottage or other. Perhaps they'll let us get warm. Perhaps they'll treat us to something.
For certain, said Kaye with a sneer. Most probably a crossbow bolt.
It would be most sensible to keep to our plan and the river, Rageous decided in his most omniscient tone. Then we won't be at risk of getting lost. And further down the Sans Retour, there was meant to be a trapper's manufactory. There's a greater likelihood they'll put us up there.
Geralt, what do you see?
The Witcher said nothing, and fixed his eyes on the snowflakes swirling in the blizzard.
We'll follow the tracks, he finally decided.
Actually, began the vampire, but Geralt immediately interrupted him.
Follow the hoof prints. Ride.
They spurred their steeds, but didn't get very far. They ventured not more than a quarter of a furlong into a gorge.
That's it,
Angoulême stated a fact, looking at the quite smooth and virginal snow.
Now you see it, now you don't. Like an elven circus.
What now, Witcher?
Kair turned around in the saddle.
The tracks have ceased. They've been covered up by the blizzard.
No, they haven't, Milva said. The blizzard doesn't reach here, in the canyon.
What happened to the horse, then?
The archer shrugged, huddled up in the saddle, pulling her head into her shoulders.
Where's that horse?
Kair wasn't giving up.
Did it vanish? Evaporate? Or perhaps we imagined it? Geralt? What do you say?
The gale howled above the ravine, whipping up and swirling the snow.
Why?
Asked the vampire, scrutinizing the Witcher intently. Did you order us to follow those tracks, Geralt?
I don't know, he confessed a moment later. I felt something. Something touched me. Never mind what.
You were right, Regis. Let's go back to the Sans Retour and keep by the river without any excursions or diversions that might end badly. According to what Reynard said, the real winter and bad weather only begin in the Malheur Pass. When we get there, we'll have to be sound in body. Don't just stand there, we're turning around.
Without having cleared up what happened to that strange horse?
What's there to explain? The Witcher said bitterly. The tracks were swept away and that's that. Anyway, maybe it really was a mouflon.
Milva looked at him strangely, but refrained from comment. When they returned to the river, the mysterious tracks were no longer there either, for they had been covered up by wet snow. Thrasil was floating densely. Pieces of pack ice were swirling and turning around in the tin-grey current of the Sans Retour.
I'll tell you something, Angoulême piped up, but promise you won't laugh.
They turned around. In her woolen pom-pom hat pulled down over her eyes, with cheeks and nose red from the cold, wearing a shapeless sheepskin coat, the girl looked funny, a dead ringer for a small, plump kobold.
I'll tell you something about those tracks. When I was with Nightingale in the Hansa, they said that during the winter, the Mountain King, leader of the Ice Demons, rides on an enchanted horse in the passes. To meet him face to face is certain death. What do you say to that, Geralt? Is it possible that...
Anything, he interrupted her. Anything's possible. On we go, company. Before us is the Malheur Pass.
The snow lashed and whipped. The wind blew, and ice demons whistled and wailed amidst the blizzard. Except the moor she'd landed on wasn't the one she knew, Ciri realized at once. She didn't even have to wait until evening. She was sure she wouldn't see the two moons. The forest along whose edge she rode was as wild and inaccessible as the other one, but differences could be seen. Here, for example, there were more birches and fewer beeches. She hadn't heard or seen any birds there, while there were great numbers of them here. There had only been sand and moss between the clumps of heather. Here, whole carpets of green club moss sprawled. Even the grasshoppers running from under Kelpie's hooves were somehow different here, somehow familiar. And then, her heart began beating harder. She saw a track, overgrown and neglected, leading into the forest. Ciri looked around carefully and made sure the strange track didn't go any further, that it ended here, that it didn't lead to the forest, but from it or through it. Without deliberating for long, she prodded the mare's sides with her heels and rode between the trees. "I'll ride south," she thought. "If I don't come across anything to the south, I'll turn around and ride in the opposite direction, beyond the moor." She trotted beneath a canopy of boughs, looking around attentively, trying hard not to overlook anything important. Because of that, she didn't overlook an old man peeping out from behind an oak tree. The old man, who was very short but not at all stooped, was dressed in a linen shirt and trews made from the same material. On his feet he had huge and very funny-looking bast slippers. In one hand he held a gnarled stick and in the other a wicker basket. Ciri couldn't see his face precisely, for it was hidden by the frayed and drooping brim of a straw hat, from under which protruded a sunburnt nose and a tangled grey beard. "Fear not," she said. "I won't do you any harm." The grey-bearded man shifted his weight from one foot to the other and removed his hat. He had a round face flecked with liver spots, ruddy and not very wrinkled, thin eyebrows, and a small and very receding chin. His long grey hair was tied up on his nape in a queue, but the top of his head, meanwhile, was completely bald, as yellow and shiny as a pumpkin. She saw him looking at her sword, at the hilt extending above her shoulder. "Don't be afraid," she repeated.
"No, oh," he said, mumbling a little. "Oh, oh, my young maiden. Forrest Graham sitting afraid. He ain't one of those fearful types, oh no."
He smiled. He had large, very protruding teeth because of a bad occlusion and receding jaw. It was because of that he mumbled so much.
"Forrest Graham's ain't afraid of wanderers," he repeated, "or even brigands. Forrest Graham's is poor. He's a poor thing. Forrest Graham's is peaceful. He don't disturb no one, eh?"
He smiled again. When he smiled, he seemed to be all front teeth.
"And you, young lass, aren't you afraid of Forrest Graham's?"
Ciri snorted.
"I'm not. Just imagine. I'm not the fearful kind either."
"Well, I never."
He took a pace towards her, resting on his stick. Kelpie snorted. Ciri tugged on the reins.
"She doesn't like strangers," she warned, "and she bites."
"Forrest Graham's nose. Bad, unruly mare. Where are you riding from, miss? Where are you heading, may I ask?"
"It's a long story. Where does this road lead?"
"Don't you know that, miss?"
"Don't answer questions with questions, if you don't mind. Where will that road take me? What place is this in any case? And what time is it?"
The old man stuck his teeth out again, moving them like a koipu.
"Hey, he mumbled. "Well, I never. What time, you ask, miss? Oh, I see you've travelled from far away. From far away to Forrest Graham's, miss."
"From quite far away indeed." She nodded indifferently. "From other
places and times,"
he completed a sentence.
"Graham's knows. Graham's guessed."
"What?" she asked, excited. "What did you guess? What do you know?"
"Forrest Graham's knows much."
"Speak."
"Miss must be hungry."
He stuck out his teeth.
"Thirsty? Fatigued? If you want, miss, Forrest Graham's will take you to his cottage. Feed you, give you drink, take you in."
For a long time, Ciri hadn't had the time or the peace of mind to think about rest or food. Now the words of the strange old man tightened up her stomach, knotted up her guts, and tied up her tongue. The old man observed her from under the brim of his hat.
"Forest grams," he mumbled, "has meat in his cottage, has spring water, and has hay for the mare, the bad mare that wanted to bite good old Grams, hey? Everything is in Forest Grams' cottage, and we'll be able to talk about other places and times. It's not far at all, oh no. Will a young traveller avail herself? Won't disdain a visit to poor old Grams?"
Ciri swallowed. "Lead on." Forest Gramps turned around and shambled down a barely visible path among the thicket, measuring off the road with energetic swings of his stick. Ciri rode behind him, dipping her head under branches and reining Kelpie back. The mare was indeed determined to bite the old man, or at least eat his hat. In spite of his assurances, it wasn't near at all. When they got there, to a clearing, the sun was almost at its zenith. Gramps' cottage turned out to be a picturesque shack on stilts, with a roof that had clearly often been patched up using whatever happened to be to hand. The shack's walls were covered with hides resembling pigskin. In front of the cottage, there was a wooden construction shaped like a gallows, a low table and a chopping stump with an axe stuck in it. Behind the cottage was a hearth made of stones and clay with a large blackened cauldron on it.
"This is Forest Gram's home,"
the old man indicated with his stick, not without pride.
"Forest Grams lives here. He sleeps here. He cooks vettles here, should he have something to cook. It's a hardship, a severe hardship to get vettles in the forest. Does Miss Wanderer like pearl barley?"
"She does." Ciri swallowed again. "She likes everything."
"With a bit of meat? With some grease? With scratchings?"
"Mm-hmm."
"And it don't look,"
Gramps shot her an appraising glance,
"that Miss has lately tasted meat and scratchings often. Oh, no. You're skinny, Miss. Skinny. Skin and bones. And what's that behind your back, Miss?"
Ciri looked around, taken in by the oldest and most primitive trick in the book. A terrible blow of the gnarled stick caught her right in the temple. Her reflexes helped only in that she raised her arm and her hand partly cushioned a blow capable of smashing her skull like an egg. But in any case, Ciri ended up on the ground, stunned, bewildered, and completely disorientated. Gramps, grinning, leapt at her and struck her again with the stick. Ciri once again managed to shield her head with her hands, with the result that both flopped down inertly. The left one was definitely injured, the metacarpals probably shattered. Gramps, leaping forward, attacked from the other side and whacked her in the stomach with his stick. She screamed, curling up into a ball. Then he stooped on her like a hawk, turned her over face downwards, and pinned her down with his knees. Ciri tensed up, kicked back hard, missing, then delivered a vicious blow with her elbow, this time hitting the target. Gramps roared furiously and smashed her in the back of the head with his fist so powerfully she lurched face first into the sand. He seized her by the hair on her nape and pressed her mouth and nose against the ground. She felt herself suffocating. The old man kneeled on her, still pressing her head against the ground, tore the sword from her back and cast it aside. Then he began to fiddle with his trousers. He found the buckle and unfastened it. Ciri howled, choking and spitting sand. He pushed her down harder, immobilizing her, entangling her hair in his fist. He tore her trousers off her with a powerful tug.
"Hey," he mumbled, wheezing, "and hasn't Gramps got a nice bit of stuff? Oh, Gramps hasn't had one like this for a long, long time."
Ciri, feeling the repulsive touch of his dry, claw-like hand, yelled with her mouthful of sand and pine needles.
"Lie still, miss."
She heard him slavering, kneading her buttocks.
"Gramps isn't as young as he was. Not right away, slowly. But never fear. Gramps will do what's to be done. And then Gramps will eat his fill. Hey, his fill. Lavishly."
He broke off, roared and squealed. Feeling that his grip had eased off, Ciri kicked, jerked and leapt up like a spring and saw what had happened. Kelpie, creeping up noiselessly, had seized Forrest Gramps in her teeth by his cue and almost lifted him into the air. The old man howled and squealed, struggled, kicked and wriggled his legs, finally managing to tear himself free, leaving the long grey lock of hair in the mare's teeth. He tried to grab his stick, but Ciri kicked it out of range of his hands. She was about to treat him to another kick where he deserved it, but her movements were hindered by her trousers being halfway down her thighs. Gramps made good use of the time it took her to pull them up one-handed. He was by the stump in a few bounds and jerked the axe from it, driving the determined Kelpie away with a swing. He roared, stuck out his awful teeth, and attacked Ciri, raising the axe to strike.
"Gramps is gonna fuck you, miss," he howled wildly. "Even if Gramps has to chop you up into pieces first, it's all the same to Gramps if you're in one piece or in portions."
She thought she'd cope with him easily. After all, he was a decrepit old geezer. She was very much mistaken. In spite of his enormous slippers, he jumped like a spinning top, hopped like a rabbit, and swung the axe with the bent handle like a butcher. After the dark and sharpened blade had literally grazed her several times, Ciri realized that the only thing that could save her was to run away. But she was rescued by a coincidence. Stepping back, she knocked her foot against her sword. She picked it up in a flash.
"Drop the axe," she panted,
drawing Swallow from the scabbard with a hiss.
"Drop the axe onto the ground, you lecherous old man. Then, who knows, perhaps I'll spare your life and not cut you into pieces."
He stopped. He was panting and wheezing, and his beard was disgustingly covered in saliva. He didn't drop his weapon, though. She saw savage fury in his eyes.
"Very well."
She swung her sword in a hissing moulinet.
"Meek my day."
For a moment, he looked at her, as though not understanding. Then he stuck out his teeth, goggled, roared, and lunged at her. Ciri had had enough of fooling around. She dodged him with a swift half-turn and cut from below across both his raised arms above the elbows. Gramps released the axe from his bloodied hands, but immediately jumped at her again. She leapt aside and slashed him in the nape of the neck. More out of mercy than need, he would soon have bled to death from his two severed brachial arteries. He lay, fighting unbelievably hard not to give up his life, still writhing like a worm in spite of his cloven vertebrae. Ciri stood over him. The last grains of sand were still grating in her teeth. She spat them out, straight onto his back. He was dead before she finished spitting. The strange construction in front of the cottage, resembling a gallows, was equipped with iron hooks and a block and tackle. The table and chopping block were worn smooth, sticky with grease, and reeked horribly, like a shambles. In the kitchen, Ciri found a cauldron of the pearl barley he had offered her, swimming in grease, full of pieces of meat and mushrooms. She was very hungry, but something told her not to eat it. She only drank some water from a wooden pail and nibbled a small, wrinkled apple. Behind the shack, she found a cellar with steps, deep and cool. In the cellar stood pots of lard. Something was hanging from the ceiling. The remains of a side of meat. She ran out of the cellar, stumbling on the steps as though devils were pursuing her, then fell over in some nettles, jumped up, and ran tottering over to the cottage, grabbing with both hands one of the stilts supporting it. Although she had almost nothing in her stomach, she vomited very spasmodically for a very long time. The side of meat hanging in the cellar belonged to a child. Led by the strong smell, she found a water-filled hollow in the forest into which the prudent Forrest Gramps would throw scraps of what it wasn't possible to eat. Looking at the skulls, ribs and pelvises sticking out of the ooze, Ciri realized with horror that she was only alive thanks to the ghastly old man's lecherousness, only owing to the fact that he had felt like frolicking. Had his hunger been more powerful than his despicable sexual urges, he would have hit her treacherously with the axe, not the stick. Suspended by the legs from the wooden gallows, he would have disemboweled and skinned her, dressed and divided her on the table, chopped her up on the chopping block. Although she was unsteady on her feet from giddiness, and her left hand was swollen, and pain was shooting through it, she dragged the corpse to the hollow in the forest and pushed it into the stinking slime among the bones of his victims. She returned, covered up the entrance to the cellar with branches and twigs, and the yard and entire small holding with brushwood. Then she meticulously set fire to it all from four sides. She only rode away once it had thoroughly caught fire, when the fire was raging and roaring satisfactorily, when she was certain that no rain showers would interfere with all traces of that place being obliterated. Her hand wasn't in such bad shape. It was swollen. Indeed, it hurt awfully, but probably no bones were broken. As evening approached, only one moon indeed rose. But somehow, strangely, Ciri didn't feel like considering this world hers, nor staying in it longer than need be.
"It'll be a good night tonight," murmured Nimue. "I can sense it."
Condwiramure sighed. The horizon blazed gold and red. There was a stripe of the same colour on the lake from the horizon to the island. They sat in armchairs on the terrace, with the looking glass in the ebony frame and the tapestry depicting the old castle, hugging a rock wall behind them, looking at themselves in the mountain lake.
"How many evenings," thought Condwiramure's, "how many evenings have we sat like this until dusk has fallen, and later, in the dark, without any results, just talking?"
It was getting cool. The sorceress and the novice covered themselves with furs. From the lake they heard the creaking of the rowlocks of Fisher King's boat, but they couldn't see it. It was obscured by the brilliance of the sunset.
"I quite often dream,"
Condwiramure's returned to their interrupted conversation, "that I'm in an icy wasteland, where there's nothing but the white of the snow and mounds of ice glistening in the sun. And there's a silence ringing in the ears, an unnatural silence. The silence of death."
Nimue nodded, as though to indicate she knew what was meant, but she didn't comment.
"Suddenly," continued the novice, "suddenly I feel I can hear something, that I feel the ice tremble beneath my feet. I kneel down, rake aside the snow. The ice is as transparent as glass, as in some clear mountain lakes, when the pebbles at the bottom and the fish swimming can be seen through a layer 2 yards thick. In my dream, I can also see, although the layer of ice is dozens or perhaps hundreds of yards thick. It doesn't stop me seeing and hearing people calling for help. At the bottom, deep beneath the ice, is a frozen world."
Nimue didn't comment this time either.
"Of course, I know what the source of that dream is," continued the novice. "Eithrina's prophecy, the infamous white frost, the time of frost and the wolfish blizzard. The world dying among the snows and ice, in order, as the prophecy says, to be born again centuries later, cleansed and better."
"I believe deeply," said Nimue softly, "that the world will be born again. Whether into something better, not particularly."
"I beg your pardon?"
"You heard me.
Didn't I miss here? Nimue, the white frost has already been prophesied thousands of times. Every time the winter is severe, it's been said that it has come. Right now, even children don't believe that any winter is capable of endangering the world."
"Well, well, children don't believe. But I, just imagine, do."
"Based on any rational premises?" asked Conwyrimus with a slight sneer. "Or only on a mystical faith in the infallibility of elven predictions?"
Nimue said nothing for a long while, picking up the fur she was draped in.
"The earth," she finally began in a slightly sermonizing tone, "has a spherical shape and orbits the sun. Do you agree with that? Or perhaps you belong to one of those fashionable sects that try to prove something utterly different?"
"No, I don't. I accept heliocentrism, and I agree with the theory of the spherical shape of the earth."
"Excellent.
You are sure, then, to agree with the fact that the vertical axis of the globe is tilted at an angle, and the path of the Earth around the sun doesn't have the shape of a regular circle, but is elliptical? I learned about it, but I'm not an astronomer, so you don't have to be an astronomer. It's enough to think logically. The Earth circles the sun in an elliptical-shaped orbit, and so, during its revolution, sometimes it's closer and sometimes further away. The further the Earth is from the sun, the colder it is on it. That must be logical. And the less the world's axis deviates from the perpendicular, the less light reaches the northern hemisphere. That's also logical. Both those factors, I mean the ellipticalness of the orbit and the degree of tilt of the world's axis, are subject to changes, as can be observed, cyclical ones. The ellipse may be more or less elliptical, that is, stretched out and elongated, and the Earth's axis may be less or more tilted. Extreme conditions, as far as climate is concerned, are caused by a simultaneous occurrence of the two phenomena: the maximum elongation of the ellipse, and only an insignificant deviation of the axis from the vertical. The Earth, orbiting the sun, receives very little light and heat at the aphelion, and the polar regions are additionally harmed by the disadvantageous angle of tilt of the axis. Naturally, less light in the northern hemisphere means the snow lies longer. White and shining snow reflects sunlight. The temperature falls even more. The snow lies even longer because of that. It doesn't melt at all in greater and greater stretches, or only melts for a short time. The more snow, and the longer it lies, the greater the white and shining reflective surface. I understand. The snow's falling. It's falling and falling, and there's more and more of it. So observe that masses of warm air drift with the sea currents from the south, which condense over the frozen northland. The warm air condenses and falls as snow. The greater the temperature differences, the heavier the falls. The heavier the falls, the more white snow that doesn't melt for a long time, and the colder it is. The greater the temperature difference, and the more abundant the condensation of the masses of air, I understand. The snow cover becomes heavy enough to become compacted ice, a glacier, on which, as we now know, snow continues to fall, pressing it down even more. The glacier grows. It's not only thicker and thicker, but it spreads outwards, covering greater and greater expanses, white expanses, reflecting the sun's rays. Kundwira Muir's nodded, becoming colder, colder and even colder. The white frost prophesied by Aethlina. But is a cataclysm possible? Is there really a danger that the ice that has lain in the north forever will all of a sudden flow south, crushing, compressing and covering everything? How fast does the ice cap spread at the pole? A few inches annually? As you surely know, said Nemu, eyes fixed on the lake, the only port in the Gulf of Praxida that doesn't freeze is Pont Vanis. Yes, I'm aware. Enriching your knowledge, 100 years ago, none of the Gulf's ports used to freeze. 100 years ago, there are numerous accounts of it. Cucumbers and pumpkins used to grow in Talgar, and sunflowers and lupins were cultivated in Cairngorm. They aren't cultivated now, since their growth is impossible. It's simply too cold there. And did you know that there were once vineyards in Caedwin? The wines from those vines probably weren't the best, because it appears from the surviving documents that they were very cheap. But local poets sang their praises anyway. Today, vines don't grow in Caedwin at all, because today's winters, unlike the former ones, bring hard frosts, and a hard frost kills vines. It doesn't just retard growth, it simply kills, destroys. I understand. Yes, Nemu reflected. What more is there to add? Perhaps that it snows in Talgar in the middle of November and drifts south at a speed of more than 50 miles a day. That at the end of December and the beginning of January, snowstorms occur by the Alba, where still 100 years ago snow was a sensation. And that every child knows that the snows melt and the lakes thaw in April in our region, don't they? And every child wonders why that month is called April. The opening,
Didn't it surprise you?
Not especially, admitted Condwyr amused. Anyway, at home in Vicovaro, we didn't say April, but false bloom, or in the Elven, Birka. But I understand what you're implying. The name of the month comes from ancient times, when everything really did bloom in April.
Those distant times are all 120 years ago. That's virtually yesterday, girl. Aethlina was absolutely right. Her prophecy will be fulfilled. The world will perish beneath a layer of ice. Civilization will perish through the fault of the destroyer, who had the opportunity to open a path to hope. It is known from legend that she didn't.
For reasons that the legend doesn't explain, or explains with the help of a vague and naive moral.
That's true, but the fact remains a fact. The white frost is a fact. The civilization of the northern hemisphere is doomed to extinction. It will vanish beneath the ice of a spreading glacier, beneath permanent pack ice and snow. There's no need to panic, though, because it'll take some time before it happens.
The sun had completely set, and the blinding glare had disappeared from the surface of the lake. Now a streak of softer, paler light lay down on the water. The moon rose over Innis Vitra, as bright as a gold sovereign chopped in half.
How long? Condwyr amused asked. How long, according to you, will it take? I mean, how much time do we have?
A good deal.
How much, Nimu? Some 3,000 years.
On the lake, the Fisher King banged his oar down in the boat and swore. Condwyr amused sighed loudly.
You've reassured me a little, she said after a while. But only a little.
The next place was one of the foulest Ciri had visited. It certainly appeared in the top ranking, and at the top of that ranking. It was a port channel. She saw boats and galleys by jetties and posts, saw a forest of masts, saw sails sagging heavily in the still air. Smoke, clouds of stinking smoke, were creeping and hanging all around. Smoke also rose from behind crooked shacks by the channel. The loud, broken crying of a child could be heard from there. Kelpie snorted, jerking her head sharply, and stepped back, banging her hooves on the cobbles. Ciri glanced down and noticed some dead rats. They were lying everywhere. Dead rodents contorted in agony with pale pink paws.
Something's not right here, she thought, feeling horror gripping her. Something's wrong here. Get out of here. Run from here as quickly as possible.
A man in a gaping shirt was sitting under hanging nets and lines, his head resting on his shoulder. A few paces away lay another. They didn't look as if they were asleep. They didn't even twitch when Kelpie's horseshoes clattered on the stones right next to them. Ciri bowed her head, riding under the rags hanging from washing lines and giving off an acrid odour of filth. There was a cross on the door of one of the shacks, painted in whitewash. Black smoke left a trail in the air behind the roof. The child was still crying. Somebody shouted in the distance. Somebody closer coughed and wheezed. A dog howled. Ciri felt her hand itching. She looked down. Her hand was flecked with the black dots of fleas like caraway seeds. She screamed at the top of her voice, shaking all over in horror and revulsion. She began to brush herself off, waving her arms wildly. Kelpie, alarmed, burst into a gallop, and Ciri almost fell off. Squeezing the mare's sides with her thighs, she combed and ran her fingers through her hair. She shook her jacket and blouse. Kelpie galloped into a smoke-enveloped alleyway. Ciri screamed with terror. She rode through hell, through an inferno, through the most nightmarish of nightmares. Among houses marked with white crosses, among smouldering piles of rags. Among the dead, lying singly, and those who lay in heaps, one upon the other. And among living, ragged, half-naked spectres with cheeks sunken from pain, grovelling through dung, screaming in a language she didn't understand, stretching out towards her bony arms, covered in horrible, bloody pustules.
Run! Run from here.
Even in the black nothingness, in the oblivion of the archipelago of places, Ciri could still smell that smoke and stench in her nostrils. The next place was also a port. There was also a quay here, with a piled canal, busy with cogs, launches and other craft, and above them a forest of masts. But here, in this place, above the masts, seagulls were cheerfully screeching, and it stank in a normal, familiar way, of wet wood, pitch, seawater, and also fish in all its three basic varieties, fresh, rotten, and fried. Two men were arguing on the deck of a cog, shouting over each other in raised voices. She understood what they were saying. It was about the price of herrings. Not far away was a tavern. The odour of mustiness and beer and the sound of voices, clanking and laughter, belched from the open door. Someone roared out a filthy song, the same verse the whole time.
Lined vartele nahars in a mithil in spurs.
She knew where she was, before she'd even read on the stern of one of the galleys, Evalmur, and its home port, Bachala. She knew where she was. In Nilfgaard. She fled before anyone could pay more close attention to her. But before she managed to dive into nothingness, a flea, the last of the ones that had crawled all over her in the previous place, that had survived the journey in time and space, nestled in a fold of her jacket, leapt a great flea leap onto the wharf. That same evening, the flea settled into the mangy coat of a rat, an old male, the veteran of many rat fights, testified to by one ear chewed off right by its skull. That same evening, the flea and the rat embarked on a ship, and the next morning set sail on a voyage, on a barge, old, neglected, and very dirty. The barge was called Katrina. That name was to pass into history, but no one knew that then. The next place, difficult though it was to believe, was a truly astonishingly idyllic scene. A thatched tavern grown over with wild vines, ivy and sweet peas stood among hollyhocks by a peaceful lazy river flowing among willows, alders and oaks bent over the water, right beside a bridge connecting the banks with its elegant stone arch. A sign with gilded letters on it swung over the porch. The letters were completely foreign to Ciri. But there was quite a well-executed picture of a cat, so she assumed it was the Black Cat Tavern. The scent of food drifting from the tavern was simply captivating. Ciri did not ponder for long. She straightened her sword on her back and entered. It was empty inside. Only one of the tables was occupied by three men with the appearance of peasants. They didn't even look at her. Ciri sat down in the corner with her back to the wall. The innkeeper, a corpulent woman in a perfectly clean apron and horned cap, approached and asked about something. Her voice sounded jangling but melodic. Ciri pointed a finger at her open mouth, patted herself on the stomach, after which she cut off one of the silver buttons on her jacket and laid it on the table. Seeing a strange glance, she set to cutting off another button, but the woman stopped her with a gesture and a hissing, though nicely ringing word. The value of a button turned out to be a bowl of thick vegetable soup, an earthenware pot of beans and smoked bacon, bread, and a jug of watered-down wine. Ciri thought she'd probably burst into tears at the first spoonful, but she controlled herself. She ate slowly, delighting in the food. The innkeeper came over, jingling questioningly, and laid her cheek on her pressed-together hands. Would she stay the night?
"I don't know," said Ciri. "Perhaps. In any case, thank you for the offer."
The woman smiled and went out into the kitchen. Ciri unfastened her belt and rested her back against the wall. She wondered what to do next. The place, particularly compared to the last few, was pleasant and encouraged her to stay longer. She knew, though, that excessive trust could be dangerous and lack of vigilance fatal. A black cat, exactly like the one on the inn sign, appeared from nowhere and rubbed against her calf, arching its back. She stroked it, and the cat gently butted her palm, sat down, and began licking the fur on its breast. Ciri gazed into space, her sight drifting elsewhere. She saw Yara sitting by the fireplace in a circle of some unattractive-looking scruffs. They were all knocking over small vessels containing a red liquid.
Yara?
That's what you should do, said the boy, looking into the flames of the fire. I read about it in the History of Wars, a work written by Marshal Pellegrim. You should do that when the Motherland is in need.
What should you do?
Spill blood? Yes, precisely. The Motherland is calling, and partly for personal reasons.
Ciri, don't sleep in the saddle, says Yennefer. We're almost there.
There are large crosses painted in whitewash on the houses of the town they are arriving in, on all the doors and gates. Thick, reeking smoke. Smoke is billowing from pyres with corpses burning on them. Yennefer seems not to notice it.
I have to make myself beautiful.
A small mirror is floating in front of her face, over the horse's ears. A comb is dancing in the air, tugging through her black curls. Yennefer is using witchcraft. She doesn't use her hands at all, because her hands are a mass of clotted blood.
Mummy, what have they done to you?
Stand up, girl, says Cohen. Master your pain. Get up and onto the comb. Otherwise fear will seize you. Do you want to be dying of fear all your life? His yellow eyes shine unpleasantly. He yawns. His pointed teeth flash white. It's not Cohen at all. It's the cat. The black cat. A column of soldiers many miles long are marching. A forest of spears and standards sways and undulates over them. Yara also marches. He has a round helmet on his head and a pike on his shoulder so long he has to clutch it tightly in both hands, otherwise it would overbalance him. The drums growl and the soldiers' song booms and rumbles. Crows caw above the column. A mass of crows. A lakeshore. On the beach, white caps of whipped-up foam, rotten reeds washed up. An island on the lake. A tower. Toothed battlements, a keep thickened by the protrusions of machicolations. Over the tower, in the darkening blue of the sky, the moon shines, as bright as a gold sovereign chopped in half. Two women wrapped in furs sit on the terrace. A man in a boat. A looking glass and a tapestry. Ciri jerks her head up. Eredin Brech Lass is sitting opposite on the other side of the table.
You can't not know, he says, showing his even teeth in a smile, that you're only delaying the inevitable. You belong to us and we'll catch you. Like hell! You will return to us. You will roam a little around places and times. Then you'll reach the spiral, and we'll catch you in it. You will never return to your world or time. It's too late in any case. There's nothing for you to return to. The people you knew died long ago. Their graves are overgrown and have caved in. Their names have been forgotten. Your name also.
You're lying. I don't believe you.
Your beliefs are your private matter. I repeat, you will soon reach the spiral, and I'll be waiting there for you. You desire that secretly, don't you, Mialina Lunet?
You've got to be talking rubbish.
We Aeon Ella sense things like that. You were fascinated by me. You desired me, and feared that desire. You desired me, and you still desire me, Ziriel. Me, my hands, my touch.
Feeling a touch, she leapt up, knocking over a cup, which was fortunately empty. She reached for her sword, but calmed down almost at once. She was in the Black Cat Inn. She must have dropped off, dozing on the table. The hand that had touched her hair belonged to the portly innkeeper. Ciri wasn't fond of that kind of familiarity, but kindness and goodness simply radiated from the woman, which she couldn't pay back with brusqueness. She let herself be stroked on the head and listened to the melodic, jingling speech with a smile. She was weary.
I must write, she said at last.
The woman smiled,
jingling melodiously.
How does it happen?
Thought Ciri.
What can it be ascribed to? That in all worlds, places and times, in all languages and dialects, that one word always sounds comprehensible and always similar. Yes, I must ride to my mama. My mama is waiting for me.
The innkeeper led her out into the courtyard. Before she found herself in the saddle, the innkeeper suddenly hugged Ciri hard, pressing her against her plump breast.
Goodbye. Thank you for having me. Forward, Kelpie.
She rode straight for the arched bridge over the tranquil river. When the mare's horseshoes rang on the stones, she looked around. The woman was still standing outside the inn. Concentration, fists at her temples, a buzzing in her ears as though from the inside of a conch. A flash, and abruptly, soft and black nothingness.
Bonne chance, ma fille.
Thérèse Lapin, the innkeeper of the tavern, au chat noir im pensorion, cried after her by the highway running from Melun to Auxerre.
Have a pleasant journey.
Concentration. Fists at her temples. A buzzing in her ears as though from the inside of a conch. A flash. And abruptly, soft and black nothingness. A place. A lake. An island. The moon like a sovereign hacked in half. Its light lies down on the water in a luminous streak. In the streak, a boat. On it, a man with a fishing rod. On the terrace of the tower, two women? Condwirrmuirs couldn't bear it and screamed in amazement, immediately covering her mouth with her hand. The Fisher King dropped the anchor with a splash, swore gruffly, and then opened his mouth and froze like that. Nemu didn't even twitch. The surface of the lake, bisected by a streak of moonlight, vibrated and rippled as though having been struck by a gale. The night air above the lake ruptured like a smashed stained glass window cracks. A black horse emerged from the crack with a rider on its back. Nemu calmly held out her hands, chanting a spell. The tapestry hanging on the stand suddenly burst into flames, lighting up in an extravaganza of tiny multicolored lights. The tiny lights reflected in the oval of the looking glass, danced, teemed in the glass like coloured beads, and suddenly flowed out like a rainbow-coloured apparition, a widening streak, making everything as bright as day. The black mare reared up and neighed wildly. Nemu spread wide her arms violently and screamed a formula. Condwirrmuirs, seeing the image forming and growing in the air, focused intently. The image gained in clarity at once. It became a portal. A gate, beyond which was visible a plateau full of shipwrecks. A castle embedded in the sharp rocks of a cliff, towering over the black-looking glass of a mountain lake.
This way, Nemu screamed piercingly. This is the way you must take, Ciri, daughter of Pavetta. Enter the portal. Take the road leading to your encounter with destiny. May the wheel of time close. May the serpent Ouroboros sink its teeth into its own tail. Roam no more. Hurry. Hurry to help your friends. This is the right way, O Witcher girl.
The mare whinnied again, flailed the air with its hooves once more. The girl in the saddle turned her head, looking now at them, now at the image called up by the tapestry and the looking glass. She brushed her hair aside, and Conwyrimuas saw the ugly scar on her cheek.
Trust me, Ciri, cried Nemu, for you know me. You saw me once. I remember, they heard. I trust you. Thank you.
They saw the mare spurred on and running with a light and dancing step into the brightness of the portal. Before the image became blurred and dispersed, they saw the ashen-haired girl wave a hand turned towards them in the saddle.
and then everything vanished. The surface of the lake slowly calmed. The streak of moonlight became smooth again. It was so quiet, they felt they could hear the Fisher King's wheezing breath. Holding back the tears welling up in her eyes, Condwirrmuir's hugged Nimue tightly. She felt the little sorceress tremble. They remained in an embrace for some time, without a word. Then they both turned around towards the place where the Gate of the Worlds had vanished.
"Good luck, Witcher girl,"
they cried in unison.
"Good luck."
Close by that field where the fierce battle took place, where almost the whole force of the North clashed with almost the entire might of the Nilfgaardian invader, were two fishing villages, Old Bottoms and Brenna. Because, however, Brenna was burned down to the ground at that time, it caught on at first to call it the Battle of Old Bottoms. Today, nonetheless, no one says anything other than the Battle of Brenna, and there are two reasons for that. Primo, after being rebuilt, Brenna is today a large and prosperous settlement, while Old Bottoms did not resist the ravages of time, and all trace of it was covered over by nettles, couch grass, and burdock. Secundo, somehow, that name did not befit that famous, memorable, and, at the same time, tragic battle. For just ask yourself, here was a battle in which more than 30,000 men laid down their lives, and if Bottoms was not enough, they had to be old as well. Thus, in all the historical and military literature, it became customary only to write the Battle of Brenna, both in the North and in Nilfgaardian sources, of which, nota bene, there are many more than ours. The venerable Yara of Elendur, the Elder. Annales Suchronicae Incliti Regni Temerie. Chapter 8.
Cadet Fitz Osterlen Fail, please sit down. I wish to draw your attention to the fact that lack of knowledge about famous and important battles from the history of our fatherland is embarrassing for every patriot and good citizen, but in the case of a future officer, is simply a scandal. I shall take the liberty of making one more small observation, Cadet Fitz Osterlen. For 20 years, that is, since I've been a lecturer at this institution, I don't recall a diploma exam in which a question about the Battle of Brenna hasn't come up. Thus, ignorance in this regard virtually rules out any chances of a career in the army. Well, but if one is a baron, one doesn't have to be an officer. One can try one's luck in politics or in diplomacy, which I sincerely wish for you, Cadet Fitz Osterlen. And let's return to Brenna, gentlemen. Cadet Putkammer.
Present. Please come to the map and continue. From the point where eloquence gave up on the Lord Baron.
Yes, sir. The reason Field Marshal Menno Kuhorn decided to execute a maneuver and a rapid march westwards were the reports from reconnaissance informing that the army of the Nordlings was coming to the relief of the besieged fortress of Maena. The Marshal decided to cut off the Nordlings' progress and force them into a decisive battle. To this end, he divided the forces of the Center Army Group. He left some of his men at Maena and set off at a rapid march with the rest of his troops.
Cadet Putkammer, you aren't a novelist. You're to be an officer. What kind of expression is the rest of his troops? Please give me the exact ordre de bataille of Marshal Kuhorn's strike force, using military terminology.
Yes, Captain. Field Marshal Kuhorn had two armies under his command. The 4th Horse Army, commanded by Major General Marcus Brabant, our school's patron.
Very good, Cadet Putkammer.
Dem toady, hissed Cadet Fitz Osterlen from his desk. And the 3rd Army, commanded by Lieutenant General Retz de Melistok. The 4th Horse Army consisted of, numbering over 20,000 soldiers, the Venendal Division, the Marnia Division, the Frunsberg Division, the 2nd Vicovarian Brigade, the 3rd Deirlenian Brigade, and the Nausicaa and Vrijheth Divisions. The Third Army consisted of the Alba Division, the Dithwind Division, and the...
The Arthen Division, stated Julia Pretty Kitty Abatamarco. If you haven't ballsed anything up, of course. They definitely...